Welcome to Tribe Talk, the bi-monthly podcast by Tribe of Women. I'm Amy Robinson, founder of Tribe of Women. During each episode, I'll be joined by members of my tribe as we hear from guest speakers and powerful women who connect to our mission to establish cultures of women supporting women and recognizing more good men. We will also tell stories of you, our listeners, working in your communities to support your tribes and to answer your questions about how to grow the Tribe of Women together. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get started.
Welcome to Tribe Talk. I'm Amy Robinson. Thank you for joining us. I know you're accustomed to me being joined by a co-host, but today I wanted to make sure that we had a little extra time. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. There are all kinds of do's and don'ts being highlighted by individuals and organizations throughout the world and covering everything from prevention to how to leave. These are all good and needed conversations. So when we thought about how to best contribute to this conversation, we decided to focus our efforts this month on the judgments toward women in domestic violence situations and helping answer the question, or maybe just provide some understanding around, why doesn't she just leave? I have a personal story associated with this question, and here with me today to talk about the important topic of judgment, share the personal stories of women around the country, and help us understand how we can better support one another is Sandy Wright, founder of the organization Brave Woman. Welcome, Sandy.
Thank you, Amy. I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. As I mentioned, that this is an out of the ordinary format for us, so I'm just going to continue that theme by foregoing a bio introduction and simply diving into you telling us about yourself and why you started Brave Woman.
Well, I'm a childhood survivor with a few adult experiences thrown in. And I was a consultant for nonprofits, and I wound up doing consulting work with domestic violence shelters, 7 of them now in a couple of states. And I realized that when I would go in to talk with survivor groups, that I really needed to just be quiet and ask good questions, because mm-hmm. the wisdom, the resiliency, the wanting to thrive was right there. And also, I think the solutions are based in realities which most people don't understand. You know, what it's like to be alone in a room, dark room, and you don't know what to do, and you're just mm-hmm. waiting to see what the next thing is going to happen. Sometimes getting out of bed is a total act of bravery.
Yeah.
So I began to get a better understanding, but I didn't get in touch with my own childhood experiences until I was about 48. I told great funny stories to the family about various things that would go on. And then I was watching a movie one night and I started crying and I couldn't stop for 2 hours. And my friend who was with me said, "What's going on?" And I told just 2 stories. And she said, "Well, that's abuse." Right. And so I wound up calling my sister, who's 18 years older than I am, and asking her what it was like growing up. And she had a somewhat different experience. There were some similarities, but she had my brother in the house, so they tempered each other. And I was, you know, 18 years later, a baby in the house. So life went on. And I realized that those feelings that I had and the triggers that I had to address were really oftentimes based in all of those experiences, which then I began to acknowledge, and then I could heal.
That's amazing. Well, Brave Woman obviously is about brave women.
Yes, it is.
And can you tell us a little bit about the organization itself and what you're doing to kind of what, when we have all of these resources for women with directed toward domestic violence and how to help them, why was Brave Woman needed?
Well, I think for one thing became apparent that even among professionals who address these issues, that the survivor voice is often not in the conversation. It's not in the on boards. You know, some advocates have experience, but not all. We go to training and it becomes an education head thing when this is much more than it's a head, heart, and soul experience. And so Brave Woman was founded by survivors for survivors, and we're pretty purist about it, so that the voices and the ideas and the solutions and the concepts really are coming from people who have gone through the experience. I think there's benefits for family members and friends. Oftentimes the survivor herself, and there are some himselfs, but we're focusing on women first. And can't be stated, or we don't feel like we have a voice to really say what we're thinking and feeling. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there's not a willingness to listen because people get tired of hearing the same thing over and over again. So Brave Woman is really a survivor-to-survivor conversation. We have an online community by invitation, which we monitor, where we post questions, take polls, put on national resources. But it's primarily a way for survivors to share solutions and ideas and gain, you know, and learn from with and from one another. And then we realized that 60 to 70% of women who go through DV in their lifetime go through it without services or support. Mm-hmm. Shelters have a certain capacity. Mm-hmm. Some women are, you know, less than 10% want to go to shelters. Support mm-hmm. groups are fine, but they're intermittent. And oftentimes in between those sessions is when support is needed. So once we recognized that that was a population that was really solo, and we all know how going through hard things alone is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us to move forward. So that's our target audience. It's an audience that's challenging to reach. So we're going to beauty parlors and, you know, grocery stores and bars and gas stations, any place where we live, work, and play, churches. Mm-hmm. So our formula became a capacity of the shelters or the services in the area. And then we added another 30% for people who go to counselors or pastors, and that's how we came up with the 60 to 70%, which we've been vetting nationally. In Northwest Arkansas alone, that's 14,000 women who are going through it alone.
Mm-hmm. Northwest Arkansas is where we are right now.
Yes. Yeah. So, and we did it in Milwaukee, it's over 100,000. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that, so then we started to ask survivors, how do we reach you? Mm-hmm. When we did our 7-state tour in a small RV with therapy dog Jack,
yes,
traveling around and staying in RV parks, and you know, we'd post in an RV park, and within 30 minutes in one in Tucson, we had someone knocking on our door who said she's never told anybody, and she told us, you know, her story and her journey to where she is now in a good relationship. So it's people who are currently in it struggling. Mm-hmm. It's people who have gone through it but have not healed. And it's people who are, you know, we're perpetually in the healing process.
So you've got an organization mm-hmm. by survivors for survivors, mm-hmm. Amplifying the survivor voice to everyone around them. Because a very, very good point is that a lot of the organizations supporting women in domestic violence situations are not in those situations, or haven't been in those situations. And that's kind of growing. Now, one of the things that I notice that you say a lot is the word survivor. So tell me a little bit about why you use survivor, and also the use of the word victim and its place in the domestic violence conversation.
Well, I'm an advocate that it has no place in the conversation. I mean, if we just say the word victim, how does it make you feel, Amy?
Yeah, it makes me feel exactly like that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't understand the resiliency of a woman going through domestic violence. And like I mentioned before, getting out of bed in the morning, getting the kids off to school, going to work, figuring out how to keep, you know, things mm-hmm. somewhat healthy in the home. Mm-hmm. Those are all brave, bold acts every day. That is not a victim. That's a survivor.
It is.
And I think, you know, we understand that women can be victimized, mm-hmm. but the word survivor sort of brings up that sense of hope and resiliency, mm-hmm. which is very key to our ability to make decisions and move forward and to gain support. It doesn't mean we have to be Mary Poppins and think, you know, and be strong,
right?
Because, you know, as we learned from many places, but most recently from Brené Brown, is vulnerability is mm-hmm. key to happiness. It's key to, you know, soul connected. It's key to many things. So that's why we use survivor, and we're trying to change the language across the board, but it's very hard because people have been saying victim for a long time.
Very long time. Yes, it is. It's hard to change that language, but I'm glad that there are legal reasons, and you know, in order to have a perpetrator, there has to be a victim. Mm-hmm. And so in the legal system, which is where a lot of people start with the police and the legal system, then that word, but at what point in time perpetuating that word, but at what point in time does it change? And do we really? And I definitely have, you know, as I mentioned, I have a personal story, and this is, mine comes from being a supporter of my daughter in a domestic violence relationship. And I remember the moment that I said, "You are a victim." And she turned and looked at me and she said, "No, I'm not." Mm-hmm. And that was a huge wake-up call for me, mm-hmm. because that's exactly what she didn't need to hear. Mm-hmm. And it changed my perspective as someone that supports. So we really want to dive into...
yeah, and I think you're bringing a significant point that this is an emotional, deeply emotional and life-changing experience, not only for, you're going to get me crying, not only for the survivor, but for those around the survivor who love them.
Yes.
You know, because in some sense, the champions is what, you know, we call that circle, are survivors as well.
Yeah.
The process is different, but mm-hmm. it's as important to the whole nature of the village yeah. that gets us, you know, through this.
Yes.
And I think the other aspect of this, the other thing we're doing is we're working with the University of Oklahoma to do a HOPE survey so that we have an outcome measurement for all of our activities, mm-hmm. in addition to survivor feedback. And that HOPE survey is based on the fact that, you know, most of us calculate for grants and donors effectiveness by how many heads in beds and how many programs and how many people participate and what participants say. Mm-hmm. But just like the parent of someone going through this, you know, we need to know that there is change. There, yes. even the smallest amount of change in my hopometer,
yeah.
which is directly connected to resiliency, yes. you know. Survivors need to be able to find a way to bounce back after the last beating or the last emotional outpour. And mm-hmm. when you said that to your daughter, you know, it's sort of like you hear, "You're stupid, you can't do it, you're not yeah. worthy, you can't handle money, I'm not letting you drive the car." We, you know, the abuse pulls away yeah. everything, every ounce of everything you could think about yourself that would help you stand on your two feet.
Well, and so much of that comes from that external judgment when we're not in the situation. And we just want to, you know, when we see it from the outside, when I saw it from the outside, I just wanted to shake her and say, "Do you realize what's happening? Are you awake? Do you know that this is happening?" And victim was the word that came out. But I think that is where so much of that judgment starts, is we assume that they don't understand that it's happening. And so that's where, you know, the lack of understanding is where so much of that judgment happens. Mm-hmm. And so one of the powerful things that I think that Brave Woman is doing is capturing the stories of the women, not just that have survived past tense, but are surviving. Mm-hmm. And we're hearing from, and you have videos on the website, bravewomen.org, that are depicting the women and they are the same conversations that I've had with my daughter. She knows it. She's aware. Mm-hmm. She is cognizant. She is smart. She knows everything that's going on. And part of it is over a period of time, collecting and building the tools and the resources and the stamina and all of those other things to face what is happening and deal with what is happening and get on the other side of it, hopefully. And so I think that there is where a lot of those judgments lie. I think it's also because we're afraid of it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times we attack things that we just hope have never happened to us or will never happen to us. And it's just always this, it's other, right? It's happening to somebody else somewhere else. Another little thing that you touched on briefly is that we talk about domestic violence and we use that word violence. But abuse is synonymous and mm-hmm. synonymous. mm-hmm. And verbal abuse, emotional abuse, all of those things start
sexual,
to...
Sexual, financial, psychological, spiritual.
Yes.
That's why we say domestic violence / abuse.
Yes.
You know, sexual trafficking. I mean, who wakes up, you know, what 13-year-old wakes up in the morning and goes, I'd like to be sexual trafficked. No, you know, no. You get into it for vulnerability reasons and all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely abuse. It's a it's a bully kind of situation.
It is. So in addition to Brave Women giving giving a voice to the women dealing with it and basically helping support each other, because who understands what is happening better than another woman? So getting back to the original kind of what we were looking at in this, in the context of this conversation, is one of the things I see come up over and over and over again, and I've asked myself, and I have had asked of me in the context of what's going on with my daughter, is why doesn't she just leave? And it seems like such a big question, or a simple question. Well, why doesn't she just? And even putting that word just in there, well, just leave, mm-hmm. just go. And it is so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what patterns you're finding. Why doesn't she just leave?
Well, we're doing a video right now that opens with that, and there'll be 25 responses, and they're all different. So it's hard to give one single answer. One woman said, I was getting ready to leave, and he brought my cat into the kitchen and stuck a knife through it on the butcher block and said, you're next. And I thought, this isn't such a good day to leave, you know. One woman said he threatened to kill the kids, and that day he picked our son up from school early, and I didn't know where they were, so I couldn't leave. Another woman said, I have no money and no one to go to, and he pays the bills. Mm-hmm. Where would I go? You know, another woman was in shelter, and they had a 30-day rule that they extended for her to 60 days, but after that, you know, she still didn't have a job. She didn't have a house. I think there are women who of means, who have stature in the community, and, you know, their husband's a, you know, big dude somewhere in corporate or he's a pastor.
Yeah.
And she sees no way out, or they're getting counseled that you just have to get through this. He's really a good guy. I think the reasons are endless. And then I think the other thing we have to acknowledge is, you know, I said to a friend who tried to quit smoking 7 times, mm-hmm. how many times did it take you to quit smoking when you know it was your health and everything else? And, and you know, there were 65 reasons. Well, I was stressed. Well, this, you know, I don't think it's, I think one of the fallacies about people who experience domestic violence is that it's a unique situation. It's a unique environment. It's a unique experience. But if we think every woman in every room has gone through a dark period, mm-hmm. has gone through going to a job that people don't treat each other well, mm-hmm. you know.
And a toxic environment.
Yeah, I worked in a group for a while, and it was so much a toxic environment, and there was so much, the culture was so negative, mm-hmm. that going in that door was painful. Yeah. So I think that we have to realize that, you know, you asked before about understanding. I don't understand what it's like to be a, you know, a young African-American woman. I will never know what that's like. Mm-hmm. People who haven't gone through domestic violence will never know what it's like. And I think the closest we can get to is to think about our own experiences of dark moments or our own experiences of fear that mm-hmm. permeates everything you do.
All your decisions,
All your decisions or choices you made that you wish you had made a different choice, but too late, too bad, too sad.
Yeah.
You know, and you or I or someone else that's going through some of that may have resources mm-hmm. that help us through, or a good friend who isn't tired of hearing us. And, you know, I have one, a matter of fact, she's going to be in town shortly, who, you know, I've known for 40 years, mm-hmm. and she probably knows more about me than any other human, mm-hmm. and she still loves me.
Yeah.
You know? And she listens
despite
to me.
Everything.
So, you know, not everybody has that kind of a resource. And I think that's where our understanding comes from, not from looking at the other, but from mm-hmm. looking in our own life and self, and then being open to connect with an experience someone else might have.
And it is really hard to keep those doors open as someone that's supporting that situation, supporting the person in that situation. It's hard to keep those doors open because it is frustrating and it is exhausting. And, you know, there was a period of time where the only way to keep the toxic relationship and the danger out of our own family, because you talk about how it affects an entire family, out of her brother's lives and our lives, was to not have her in our life. And to very specifically say, we have to have a boundary. We have to make this choice, and you are a conduit for him to get into our lives. And that is a challenge for us. Now, we didn't completely cut off communication or say you can never come back or that you're a terrible person. We just said, as long as this relationship is manifesting and it is threatening us, we have to not have that in our lives. But the door was always open, and over time and a lot of challenges, we've maintained that door open. And so the one thing that happens a lot in domestic violence is the isolation. And so the isolation is the most dangerous thing for the person in that situation. And so how do we keep those doors open? How do we keep those conversations? How do we let that person know that there is always a way? And we found that through a lot of hard work, and our relationship is strong, but she's still struggling.
Well, and I think you bring up, you all are pretty amazing. I mean, just being aware of the journey, because I think there's two things that war with each other, because especially for mothers and people around, and women are such caretakers.
Yes.
And some men, but women are such caretakers, that balance between separation, and keeping the doors open, really is a boundary issue. And it's a negotiation. And sometimes we have to negotiate in a way that's not mutually agreeable. But, I think it's setting boundaries with love. And boundaries are, here is what we're willing to do. But I'm always here to listen to you. I'm always here to have you, relate to me or share with me what you want. I'm always here to support you in any ways I can outside of this boundary.
Yeah.
So to say, as long as that relationship's going, there's not going to be any direct interaction, particularly with him, is a certainly wise boundary. And I heard that from women in the seven-state tour. That was the one thing they found to be, not one, it was one of the things they found to be the most difficult, because it's a boundary like, you'll never do that again, I'm leaving. And then he brings flowers and, wine home, and then the boundary goes away. Yeah. And then you set up another boundary like, I have one day a week that's mine. And then he says, well, I want to take you someplace, or I want to go shopping, and you let the boundary go. A family who says, you are not to contact us again, to an abuser, and the abuser keeps contacting, and the family responds. So it sounds, easier when you talk about it as a boundary. Of course, we all set boundaries.
Yeah.
Well, they're porous. And I think with your, what you described is, we can't have porous boundaries in some of those things. We have porous boundaries with the person we love and support.
That's very, very, very true. Very true. What do you think? So let's talk a little bit about judgment and the judgment that women in domestic violence situations face, in addition to why doesn't she just leave, and some of the social stigmas and some of the other challenges. Actually, as a supporter of my daughter, I felt I had a great support system of friends, a wonderful tribe. But these situations can go on for years, maybe decades sometimes. And so, when it's the narrative over and over and over again, and you're talking to your friends about it, and then they're getting exhausted. And then I felt a little bit of my daughter's almost shame, and knowing that some of the things I was saying, I felt like were excuses, when they were asking me, why is this not easier to just go? Why don't you just yank her out of there? Why don't you just do all of these other things? And I think one of the things that is a path to understanding is the deep psychological games and damage that's being done kind of under the surface that no one can understand or explain unless they're going through it. So we see a lot of times these very smart. So one of the other things I did was I shared very openly with some even acquaintances, and I found out how common this story is. Mm-hmm. Very successful women saying, she's going to make it because I was her age and I did it. Mm-hmm. And I went through that and I'm here on the other side. And so, of course, as a parent, that gave me a lot of hope, mm-hmm. and that was great. But the fact that we don't talk about it sometimes prevents us from having those conversations and hearing those stories, yes. and knowing that there's another side. So how do we encourage the telling of these stories and the sharing of these stories and these connection points, free of judgment and an understanding of kind of the psychological undercurrents that are going on?
Well, I think that the key word that you said is shame. Mm-hmm. And it's not only the shame of the survivor, like, I feel really stupid for still being in this, or I really feel stupid for not, I mean, I've said that. I said about something, I feel dumb for not leaving yeah. 7 years ago, you know. So I think that that feeling of shame is a huge stop to any action. And in terms of parenting, the shame of the mom or the dad is, yeah. I am a really lousy parent. Yeah. So what do I have to do to say, you know, mm-hmm. and then the shame of the best friend is, you know, we've helped each other through so much stuff and I'm not having any effect on this whatsoever. So, and then you have the shame of the kids, and we haven't talked about the kids yet, mm-hmm. Who have to go to school, and then somehow a kid in school finds out, and then the kid gets bullied or ridiculed, mm-hmm. or he hasn't slept because people have been fighting all night and they have to go to school and they flunk their test. I mean, or they overachieve, mm-hmm. you know, where they set the bar so high and keep setting it higher because it's, I'm not going to live like that. So yeah. I think those are all issues that anyone can understand. And mm-hmm. sometimes we need to talk to some professional to, you know, to get through that.
Often.
That shame. Yeah, often.
Often.
Every week for years. And I think the other thing that's hard for survivors because, and for survivors surrounding support, mm-hmm. is, you know, again, what, just going back to B'nai Brown, it's like the marble jar friends, you know, yeah. and we hold on to half empty or a fourth empty, you know, fourth full marble jar friends because yeah. they're what's in front of us, when really what we need to do is let go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kind of get that scarcity mode about support around us, mm-hmm. and we hold on to people who are just digging us deeper into ourselves and digging us deeper into isolation.
Or perpetuating the fantasy or the fallacy, or, you know, not really digging in and helping us where we need the help. Yeah.
Yeah. Or we, you know, we live with stereotypes, which is another mm-hmm. off-putting thing. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody in domestic violence is poor, lives in a, you know, oh. crappy house, you know.
Yeah.
needs to do something with their hair and can't get through school, you know.
Has brought it on
mm-hmm. themselves when we don't realize, and we need to realize that people, even in that circumstance, are brilliantly resilient, insightful, yes. creative problem solver. They have more intelligence than people with a PhD yeah. oftentimes. So yeah. not all PhDs, but some, you know, yeah. but I think we don't realize that as humans, our human ability to walk through life with everything it brings to us and to look at Maslow's hierarchy mm-hmm. of need and how we feel that is just the same for someone with an eighth grade education as someone with a PhD. It's someone who makes $10,000 a year and someone makes, you know, $10 million a year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that human factor that I think we need to live on and move away from judgment. Which is hard for us because we go to judgment just like this.
It is that human factor. And, you know, when I would talk to people, sometimes it wasn't always a woman that had been there, done that in a situation. Sometimes it was another parent who had a child with a drug addiction. Mm-hmm. Again, also blaming themselves, not understanding how this happened. And, you know, domestic violence is sometimes the psychology of it is a little bit like addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some science behind that as well. And I think that the other thing is that when you don't know what to say or how to say it. So a lot of, you know, diminishing what happens when something does happen in a domestic violence situation. Do you diminish or excuse or, you know, try to, you know, blame yourself or explain it away or mm-hmm. act out? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for me, I, of course, I, there's no, there probably are handbooks, but none of them were helping.
Right.
And because the situation changes and it's situation to situation. But I do remember maybe a turning point, but it was that our daughter had been avoiding us. And I'm going to go on the record saying, this is my story. This is not my daughter's story. My daughter will tell her story when she's ready. Mm-hmm. And it's not even my husband's or our boys, because, you know, we can all live through the same thing and it's a different experience.
Oh, we know that.
Yeah. So, but for me, a turning point I felt was when she had been avoiding me for a few days, and she finally, said, "I'm ready to see you." And I walked in and to her apartment, and she had a black eye. And I just stood there and I just looked at her and I hugged her and I said, "I know, and I need you to know that I know, and I need you to know that I'm still here." And she's, explained it as a pinata accident, if that's even a thing. and I just looked at her and I said, "No, it wasn't. It wasn't." But I need you to know that I'm still here, and here's what we're going to do. And we're going to have a plan. And I want you to know that when you text me this, I'm going to know what you mean. And we'll be here. And if you text me this, we'll be here with police. And I need you to know that no matter what, we are safe," because he did use threatening us, her family, mm-hmm. as part of his manipulation tactic. I said, "We have everything in place. And we know what to do, and we know where to go, and I need you to rest in that." But I think that the challenge that we face is that when somebody comes to us with it was a pinata accident, or I fell, or I bumped, or this, that, or the other, we don't know what to say or how to respond. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not saying that the right thing to do is to say, "I know that that's not the truth, and I know that, and I want you to know that I'm here." It was the right for my daughter and I, in that moment, that was the right thing to do. And sometimes that's the best advice I can give, is just trust yourself mm-hmm. to know what to do in that moment. But that was a turning point, because at that point, the veil was revealed and she knew that I knew. And even though I wouldn't say that she just, came in and told me everything after that, we needed to strip away that mm-hmm. facade.
Well, and I think at that moment, your instinct, you followed your instinct.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing that I think is important about that example is it's her choice.
Yeah.
What she texts you, it's, I think we try to take over and give solutions and tell people what they need to do, and we all know that the longer we do that, the more we strip away the other person's decision, and that their leaving will never last unless mm-hmm. it's their leaving. Yeah. So I think, one response that I've used is someone will say it's a pinata accident, and I'll just go, "I really love you."
Yeah.
That's all I need to say.
Yeah.
Because that says, I don't think so, but I really love you. And, yeah.
I'm still here.
And I'm still here, mm-hmm. And I think that's what people need to hear. The three things that I asked in that video is, what does support look like? Mm-hmm. And it's listening, not judging, and being there.
Oh, yeah.
And one woman in a longer video that we have said, "I have a good friend, and no matter how many times I told her over 7 years, no matter how many times, she was always there." Mm-hmm. She didn't say, "Oh, for God's sakes, really leave this dude."
Yeah.
Or, "You're better than this," and all of that. I mean, all of those seem like caring statements, mm-hmm. but they're judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And so just saying, "I love you and I'm here, I'm going to be here," mm-hmm. lets people know that it's up to them. And that decision, lasts. Because then, someone say, "Well, why didn't they just leave? Why did they go back 4 times?
Yeah.
Well,
or more.
And there, I think that one of the things is, habit. We all develop coping mechanisms and habit. And, the other judgment that comes up, "Well, she drinks," or, "Well, she takes mm-hmm. drugs," or, "Well, she smokes," or, "Well, she, goes to the casino," mm-hmm. or whatever it is. And what we realize is that, I know a lot of people haven't been through DV who self-medicate and do other things. We all have our coping mechanisms. So who are we to judge how a person who lives in fear mm-hmm. for their life, or their kid's life, or their pet's life every day, never knowing what's going to set somebody off, how they cope. So, for example, when I was doing a group with survivors, one woman said, I learned how to lie to survive. But now I'm out meeting with people and it's become a habit and it's not working so well out there. You know, so I think for family members and friends to say, you know, you really don't have to tell a different story to me. You know, rather than saying, oh my God, you're such a liar, you know, which people are inclined to do. It's like, you don't have to make up a story for me. Is another way to help someone realize that they can shift and adjust, you know, or someone's out drinking, you know, you don't say, you know, you're an alcoholic. It's like, do you really want to drink that much? Is there something else we can do? You know, let's go shopping, or is there something else we can do? And they may say no. And we have to be okay with choices, because sometimes, unfortunately, we have to hit the floor before we can pick ourselves back up. You know, one woman had three DUIs. Is that right? DUIs? And so she said, you know, I can't have another one. I can't get to work. Or she had two, I think. The third one was going to do it. And her friend said, well, is there another way that you can help yourself through this? You know, so I think, and they may say no again, you know, and then they lose their job and hit the skids. And we have to still be there and be okay with that.
And I think the other thing I will say, and, you know, all these lists of do's and don'ts that we put out there, and, you know, I'm sharing the story of what worked, but for every story that worked, I have about 10 or 15 of the things I did not do well. That we did not do right, that did not work. And, you know, so I think that, you know, the other piece is just keep trying and forgive yourself for your own learnings and your own, you know, misguided missteps along the way. I think that that's, you know, that's a universal truth.
Let me just throw one other thing in, Amy. I'm going, you know, through this with a good friend right now. It's like I keep thinking about how she could change to make things better. And, you know, I thought about that for 2 days. And then I woke up in the morning and I thought, well, that's dumb, Sandy. You're the only one that can make a difference and change. And so I really thought about it. I took I went for a long walk and I thought about what I needed to do to shift, to make an opening for the other person to shift if she wanted to, if she chose to. And I've learned this lesson 1,000 times and I have to learn it every time all over again, because I go right to, this is what the other person needs to do. You know, it's a natural instinct. Yes. But once we get that we're the ones that need to change, you know, you did 1,000 things or 100 things that didn't work. And so the realization was not that you read a book and all of a sudden you miraculously thought of something different. You shifted internally and began to get connected in a different way. And that allowed your daughter to begin to shift. And I think that's one of the most important things when we talk about understanding. You know, that understanding really is a first we understand ourselves and what's going on inside of ourselves. Then we can begin to create an opening for the other person to walk in.
Oh, I love that. That is so true. And the idea that the only person we have control over is ourselves ultimately, it's especially hard when it comes to our children.
I don't have control over myself most of the time.
Exactly. Well, I don't know. We could go on. I know that we could go on for probably another hour and a half. And I think that it would all be worth it, every word. But I really want to leave everybody with encouraging to go and explore Brave Woman. You have so many things going on that are all different facets. And I think probably the most important thing is who we're hearing from through Brave Woman, and whose voice is being magnified, and whose stories we're hearing, and the humanizing of the experience. So, before we get to our final question, I would like you to tell us how we can support Brave Woman, and where we can find you.
Well, you can support Brave Woman, and I mean this with my whole heart, by beginning to try to create an opening for people that are going through it. If it's one in four women, and there are six women in a room, chances are at least one of them that you don't know is going through it. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Secondly, if you're a survivor, go to survivor.bravewoman.org. And it's a by invitation, so request an invitation to join in the conversation. People come and go because people, you know, move, but we have people all over the country. And right now, I think we're in like 12 states. And we're setting up a local Brave Woman community so that people can, who aren't connected to support or other things, can find out about that in their local areas. Bravewoman.org website, there are postings and videos will be going up there. Right now, there's 1.5 of us working on this organization. We have a national board. I mean, 1.5, truly. We have a national board, and we're fortunate to have University of Oklahoma, UWM, and now Georgetown University is working with us on a communication plan. And we have great volunteers, but we're waiting to get a couple of grants and some funding in order to be able to bring some people on to, you know, further this. Mm-hmm. And then we have a Facebook page where we post insights from survivors, some stories, ask questions of people to, you know, to give. And then there's always the most loathed conversation, which is you can donate.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't do services because we feel like there's enough of that out there. And again, because of the 60 to 70% of women who don't go and can't or don't seek services, that's not what we're about. But if we can provide tools for people to begin to come to a greater understanding for themselves and to connect, we think that's where we're going nationally.
And for women in domestic violence situations right now, those are also safe connections. You've put some barriers and ways that that those are safe connections, ways to interact.
They're as safe as we've taken every precaution that we can for an online. And we're a partner with the National Network to End Domestic Violence in D.C.
Oh, great.
All the state coalitions belong to them and all the shelters belong to them. So we really bounce everything up against their kind of 30,000 foot view of that in terms of safety and legality. And then survivors are our primary advisors. So we'd love to reach as many survivors as possible. And if there's 14,000 just in Northwest Arkansas alone, much less other cities and rural areas, we have a lot of work to do. And we can do that as a tribe of women.
We can.
Yes.
So, which is a great segue into our last and always question, which is, why do you believe in tribes of women?
I think the power of women connecting. You know, I've been through... Now I'm going to tell myself, but, you know, the women's movement and other things that have gone on over the past and have seen what happens when women connect, unite, and are open to one another, what we can do, what we can change. Civil rights movement, if you look at women, the movement in Northern Ireland led by, you know, a woman, I think that social change and quality of life and thriving is made richer by tribes of women. We can also be our worst enemies at times, and by what you're doing, Amy, and what you and your team is doing is bringing us together in a positive way to support one another. So I'm pleased to be part of the tribe of women.
Thank you very much. And thank you for being part of my tribe and everything that you're doing just on a national, international, and level. Everything that you're doing is wonderful, and thank you.
You're most welcome.
Do you believe in tribes of women? Join the movement in our newsletter at tribeofwomen.com and be the first to learn about upcoming podcast guests, product releases, events, and giveaways. Find, subscribe, and rate the Tribe Talk podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, and other major platforms, and share it with your tribe. Then follow us for inspiration, information, events, and more on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using @tribeofwomen. This is Tribe of Women.
Lorraine Mosier,
Courtney Lawless,
Laurie Marshall,
and Amy Robinson. Thanks for listening.